Clerk will call the docket.
Lori B. Lane versus Dave B. Lane Servicing, LLC, and all. Drew B. Barrett, Ian B. Vance, counsel for appellate. Christie O. Murphy, Richard D. Craig, Amy O. Bradley, counsel for appellate.
Thank you.
All right, Madam Clerk, don't start the clock just yet. You may come up. Now, do I understand that the appellees are going to share argument? Is that correct?
We'd like to ask for permission to do so.
Yes.
Yeah. Christie Murphy represents Amy Lane, so I'd like to speak for 10 or 11.
All right.
Christie Murphy would like to speak for 5.
And do you represent equity trustees as well as Eric Allman?
No, this is Eric Allman.
Just, all right, so do you represent equity trustees?
I represent Dave B. Lane Servicing.
So nobody represents equity trustees?
Correct.
All right, do they know that?
I believe so.
All right. The court has a policy that we try to follow and respect the wishes of not only the litigants before the court, but their lawyers. And it's different. If you are splitting issues for the same parties, you have a certain amount of time, and it's up to you to manage it. But when you're representing different parties, the court recognizes that you have certain rights and interests that we'd like to accommodate. So when you get up there, the clock is going to have 10 minutes for you, and when the red light goes off, you're not going to eat into his time. So you'll have 5 minutes independent of her 10. All right. Any questions about that? All right. Your motion is granted. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Drew Surrett. I'm counsel for the appellant, Gloria B. Lane. As an initial matter, I respectfully request to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal argument. I'll do my best to stop at 11 minutes then.
You'll have your challenge, I assure you.
In this appeal, Mrs. Lane contends that the trial court erred in sustaining the plea of res judicata filed by Bayview Loan Servicing. There was a first action which we characterize as a petition for temporary injunctive relief, and this appeal arises out of a second action which was filed against the appellees, including Bayview, Mr. Von Allman, and equity trustees to set aside a completed foreclosure sale and seek compensatory damages as to Bayview. It's our position that the first action, because it sought only a temporary injunction, the denial of that petition as a matter of law cannot be the basis for claim preclusion to bar the second action. This court has pointed out in the briefing that I filed on behalf of Ms. Lane has found that rulings on temporary injunctions are interlocutory. They don't finally adjudicate the rights of the parties. It's basically a stop, and what happens is there's further proceedings following that. Now, this petition, admittedly, that was filed in the first action was inartfully drafted, but I think there's certainly indicia in those proceedings and the petition itself that Mrs. Lane only sought temporary injunctive relief and the trial court only considered temporary injunctive relief. For instance, the trial court in the first action heard that petition.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, there's, help me think through your point. You can go into court and ask for a temporary injunction, and that be all you ask for. I need a temporary injunction for 10 months. It's temporary, it's not permanent. And that can be a final order entered in on that. You can either deny it or grant it if you're a circuit court judge. So the temporary nature of the scope of relief is not the test for whether or not the proceeding is temporary. The proceeding is temporary only if you tell the judge, after you give me your temporary injunction, I'm going to be later asking for a final injunction. So don't let the cows out yet. I'm going to be here. What is it about the first proceeding that looked like the latter scenario?
I think there's several factors. Number one, if in fact a trial court is going to treat a request for a temporary injunction as resulting in a final order, there would need to be full legal proceedings, in my opinion. So in this case, there was essentially an emergency hearing that was heard 2 business days after the filing. Additionally, the defendant in that case, and I think it's important to point out, in the trial court found they weren't it wasn't the proper defendant. So that's another part of the argument. But nonetheless, the defendant never filed a responsive pleading. The parties were not at issue. And as I pointed out in the opening brief and the reply brief, there is good case law from this court that says if you file an action in circuit court and the parties are not at issue, meaning there's no responsive pleading filed and there's no default entered, which results in admission of all the allegations in the complaint, you cannot have a final order adjudicate that proceeding. And so I think when you look at the totality of the circumstances of that first action, it's clear that regardless of the fact that there were no further proceedings following the entry of that injunction order, it could not have possibly been a final order because it was conducted on an emergency basis. There was no responsive pleading filed. There was no actual trial. The respondent in that petition was served with the complaint the same day that the emergency injunction hearing was conducted. And I think in one of the briefs that was filed by Mr. Von Allman, it was admitted that it was an emergency hearing, essentially. And I think fundamentally you have a problem where a trial court engages in action that really, in effect, deprived Mrs. Lane of a full and fair final hearing on the allegations that she made, and then uses that action to preclude her from a further litigation. Of course, that's involving separate and distinct parties from what occurred in the injunction act.
Why don't you move on to that?
Yeah. As the court is aware, both res judicata, which I'll refer to as claim preclusion, and collateral estoppel, which I'll refer to as issue preclusion, require the involvement of the same parties or their privies. In this case, in the first action, the trial court specifically found that BWW Law Group was not a proper party. So it is a necessary inference from that finding that there was no cause of action against BWW Law Group. Because there's no cause of action against BWW Law Group, it can't be said that Mrs. Lane asserted the same cause of action against the appellees in this case, nor, in my opinion, can it be said that that BWW is in privity with Bayview and Mr. Von Allman. Now, there's been, I think, contention by Bayview that, in fact, privity is not, in fact, required for the application of res judicata claim preclusion, but I think it's right there in Rule 16A that, in fact, it has to be to be barred, the second or subsequent civil action has to be against the same opposing party. In this case, the trial court below really, I think, respectfully paid short shrift to whether or not Bayview was, in fact, in privity with BWW Law Group. Perhaps if Mrs. Lane had filed the initial petition against equity trustees, I think the argument for privity would be much stronger. But in the second action, you have 2 appellees, Bayview and equity trustees, who were not involved in the first action. And really, BWW, I don't think, could have been barred by the injunction order, because BWW was not the proper party to be named. So an injunction order barring BWW Law Group would be against the wrong party, and I think would be unenforceable. And, of course, underlying this issue of claim preclusion and issue preclusion is the concept that to be able to use those as a defense against a claim, you have to have been in the position where you'd be bound by the prior judgment. And as soon as the trial court found in the injunction order and at the beginning of that proceedings that the wrong party had been named, that's it. You cannot get relief against the wrong party. And the findings that followed that, in my opinion, in the injunction order that was entered in the first action are superfluous. They don't bind anyone because you cannot enter an injunction order to bar a party from taking action that it's not actually taking. It's as if I sue my neighbor's lawyer for my neighbor discharging effluent onto my property. The trial court is going to find, as a matter of law, that the neighbor's lawyer is not the party to be enjoined from discharging sewage or waste onto my property. And in my opinion, that's the end of the that's the end of the analysis.
Well, it's the end of collateral estoppel analysis, but you still have to process your claim preclusion argument.
I think that's correct, but I don't think that the court can finally adjudicate the merits of a claim against an improperly named party. That's my contention, is that the failure to name equity trustees or Bayview or any of these parties that are actually engaged in the machinery of this foreclosure process means that Mrs. Lane is not precluded from pursuing her claims against Bayview and Mr. Von Allman and equity trustees in this action, because those are all, in my opinion, and is pointed out in the brief, they're all advisory opinions. The court is basically saying, you've named the wrong party, you can't get relief. But and I understand why counsel in the first action did this. Mr. Michael, who represented Bayview in that action, you know, he saw it as an opportunity to forestall future litigation by Mrs. Lane. So there's an additional findings that are included in that order. But again, they're advisory. They're respectfully meaningless because they're entered against a party that really has no stake ultimately in the outcome of that case, because the trial court was not in a position to bar BWW from taking any action. Now, the last thing I'll say before my time runs out is, underlying this court's decision making on claim preclusion and issue preclusion is this concept that a plaintiff only have one full and fair opportunity to bring their cause. And I don't think it can be said that Bayview, Mr. Von Allman, or equity trustees are really having to relitigate the same issues that were raised in the first action. They were not involved. They engaged in separate and distinct conduct, and they incurred no potential liability in that action because it named the wrong party. And so I don't think there's any risk here that Mrs. Lane is able to engage in a multiplicity of lawsuits because these parties were not involved in that action. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christy Murphy, and I'm here for and on behalf of Bayview Loan Servicing. Today, judges, Bayview Loan Servicing asked this court to affirm the ruling of the Mecklenburg Circuit Court, where it sustained the plea of res judicata, in order to continue to provide the clarity the amended Rule 1-6 provided to us on res judicata in 2006.
Do you believe that 1.6 did away with common law privity, and that was the intent of the rule?
I don't think so, Judge.
I think if privity still exists, how are these parties in privity? BWW didn't conduct the foreclosure, had no right to conduct the foreclosure.
What I'd ask the court to focus on is, while I know there is no bright line rule for privity, and privity can vary factually amongst cases, what I'd ask the court to focus on is the case law from this court that says that when privity, you really focus on the relationship or you focus on what the party is trying to accomplish. In
his
fact,
point is, it's a very clever point. He says, well, reciprocity is the larger issue. You can't enforce res judicata against someone who can't benefit from it if the facts went the other way. So BWW was the wrong party. It's like it's no hook to hang the towel on. There's a wrong party, so privity doesn't have anything to hang on. Do you see conceptually what he's trying to say?
I do, Judge. I do conceptually see what he's trying to say, but I don't think it that the court needs to reverse the trial court based on that issue for a number of reasons. The first reason is, in specifically in Patterson v. Saunders, this court found on the privity issue, privity refers to one whose interest has been represented at trial. Here, there cannot be a question that BWW's appearance at the first action was to prevent an injunction of and to prevent the cessation of the foreclosure sale. In this particular action, it is clear that Bayview conducted the sale and they don't want the sale to be rescinded. So the issue becomes, the real question on privity becomes, was Bayview's interest adequately represented or represented in a way in which the court can establish a privity relationship between BWW and Bayview? And I think on that standard, the answer is yes.
There's a legal very broad definition of privity, though, that would allow an interloper to effectively be in privity with you without authorization, without a relationship, just because the interloper is very effective at representing your interests against your will.
But that's not what happened here, Judge.
I know, but your principle is very broad, and it could potentially allow that to happen.
And what about mutuality? Do you think if they had entered an injunction against your lawyer, you guys would be prevented from litigating that issue ever again?
I don't think so, Judge, but I would ask the court, and the court has been asked a number of times in the past, and you haven't done it yet, but I would ask the court in this context to consider that in a factual situation like this, I mean, to be clear, Ms. Lane created the issues that she has in this case. She sort of is using some of them as a sword and shield. I was the one, she knew what Bayview's role was in the process. She knew what Equity Trustee's role was in the process. She filed the lawsuit. She didn't name either one of them. Carry that a step forward. That's sort of suggesting if because of that reason and because of the lack of mutuality, res judicata does not serve as a bar, then I could see a situation, I hope I wouldn't see a situation, but I could see it, where you sort of have a dry run. I won't name necessary parties. We'll get a ruling entered, and because I didn't name necessary parties or what are deemed necessary parties, I get a do-over. I don't think that I hope that the court would not use mutuality.
It's
in that
not
way.
A do-over because if you don't name necessary parties, you're not going to get a judgment on the merits against the people you want to get it against anyway.
Well,
so how could it be a dry run in that regard?
But I don't think that's the conclusion, Judge, because if, for example, in the Cisco Trust case, when the court was analyzing whether the necessary party doctrine had anything to do with subject matter jurisdiction, finding that it did not, you said in that case, and I think Your Honor wrote the opinion in the case that followed in 2015 on Marble Technologies, that in that scenario, the trial court has the ability to exercise the jurisdiction even without the party that would be deemed the party in interest to the issue before the court. The reason for that, the subject matter issue, and the reason that the court can exercise jurisdiction in its discretion is because there are examples like this particular case where the right party's interest is adequately and certainly being represented in the proceeding before the court. On mutuality, Judge, if the court were to say that mutuality is required, and I hope the court does not necessarily make that finding, Mrs. Lane would have created the issue and then benefited from the issue. What I asked the court to do in this particular case on the mutuality issue...
What's the benefit? How does she benefit?
Because what the Mecklenburg Circuit Court... If the court is reversed and we're remanded to trial, then she's going to get a second run at the exact same issue, which is, did Bayview Loan Servicing send a proper acceleration notice? In fact, the final order in the first action on its second page at paragraph 4 specifically states that Bayview Loan Servicing sent a proper acceleration notice as required by paragraph 17 of the deed of trust. So there's no question their interests were represented. There's no question that their interests were before the court, and that finding was made. Now Ms. Lane wants the same court to consider the same issue and decide again whether or not a proper seller.
The trial judge in the first case said that, but it was utterly dicta. What basis did the trial judge have to make any ruling on the merits? He didn't even have the right party at all before him. And it does look as though the judge, for other reasons, went beyond what he needed or she needed to do. Res judicata wouldn't apply to that, stare decisis wouldn't apply to that, and precedent wouldn't apply to that. It's just dicta.
I don't think it is, Judge. I think that judge had the discretion to take jurisdiction over the issue and make factual findings. I mean, look at it from
I guess I keep coming back to the fact of, I don't think you'd be saying the same thing if all those factual findings were things that were detrimental to your client. You'd be like, oh yeah, we're definitely bound. The judge didn't have to rule on this, but he said all these terrible things about us, and I guess we're just stuck with it now because our lawyer was there that day. I don't think that would be your argument. And that mutuality to me seems to be a very, very important part of collateral estoppel and res judicata.
What I'd ask the court to do is follow the U.S. Supreme Court's guidance on this issue in the Park Lane case and the Blinder Tongue case, where they said what we really have to look at is res judicata, is collateral estoppel being used offensively or defensively? I know this court has addressed this a number of times before when it's been asked to provide an exception or limit the scope of mutuality in this context. I'd ask the court to consider doing it in this particular factual context.
Do you think this is offensive collateral estoppel?
No, Judge. I think this is defensive collateral estoppel. And I would ask the court to adopt, in a defensive collateral estoppel situation like this, that the mutuality, that it be an exception to mutuality, that in this particular scenario, the mutuality requirement in order for collateral estoppel to survive, to bar relitigation of that same fact, not be a necessity in order for collateral estoppel to
but
provide that
effect. But even in Blonder-Tongue, you still have to have privity. Mutuality and privity are related, but not the same ideas.
You do.
You still
yes,
have
Judge.
To have privity. So if BWW is not in privity with Bayview and Equity and Allman, we don't even get to the justification principle of mutuality or reciprocity.
But I think because Bayview's interests were represented by BWW, and in fact, what the cases from this court say is that you look at not only the relationship between the parties, but you look at the interest, the legal interest. And in this particular case, in both cases, the real question is, did Bayview or does Bayview have the ability to foreclose? Were the conditions preceding to foreclosure met in order to allow them to foreclose? The reason I think privity exists between Bayview Loan Servicing and BWW Law Group is because they were present, that issue was defended by them successfully, and that issue was adequately...
Counsel, the cases where you looked at whether the interest of the party were adequately represented and or litigated are cases where you have an actual real party before the court. In this case, you have the law firm before the court who could not in any sense be a real party to this action. So doesn't that speak against the point you're trying to make?
I don't think so, Judge. In fact, when Mr. Surrett was making his argument, part of what he said was the court found that BWW is not the proper party. The court did not actually make that finding. The court made a finding pertaining only to equity trustees and whether or not in its absence an injunction could be granted. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Richard E. Craig. I'm here on behalf of Eric von Allman. Eric von Allman was the poor guy who bought this property at foreclosure and whose title to the property now is in jeopardy as a result of what we've just heard. My approach to this is a little different. I was around in 2006 when Rule 1-6 was adopted, and I was one of the old practitioners, I think, who probably was very relieved to have that simplification and clarification of all of the various theories that go into res judicata. It was very much appreciated by the bar at that time. I think it helped us all. In 2015, Mr. Justice Kelsey gave us Funny Guy, and in my humble opinion, it reads like poetry to those of us who had struggled with res judicata for a long time. The purpose, of course, is to bring together all of these various theories into a simple three-paragraph rule that is totally clear in its purpose, to simplify, to clarify, to get us out of the weeds where we're arguing tedious postulations, scholarly theories, endless discussion of res judicata. Bring it all together so that we all understand it. In Funny Guy, the minority was not arguing about the overall theory. The minority there was pointing out that even with the rule and the changes to Rule 1-1, there is always going to be the possibility of different views and debate over whether you've got a single transaction or you've got multiple transactions. It's just the way it is. That's life. There's nothing much we can do about it. Funny Guy calls for common sense, and I think what we've got here is a case where we have finer points, as we've been discussing with respect to privity, mutuality, and so on. What we don't have here is a record that shows that the order of the circuit court was anything but a final order. It was not a temporary order. She didn't ask for temporary relief. She asked for an injunction. I made a comment somewhere along the way in the briefs that it was an emergency. It was an emergency. That hearing took place the day before the scheduled sale. But emergency doesn't equate to temporary. Emergency means we need to do it now. I think Ms. Lane had the opportunity, and she did present all of the evidence, all of the salient evidence anyway, on that particular day. That is, would be before the court if we're remanded. My problem with it is, of course, I don't represent Bayview, but I understand where Bayview is with this thing. My point is, I've got a guy who's on the other end of it. I think listening to this morning, we've got to be mindful, as Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. once said, hard cases make bad law. And I think the fact that we have a pro se plaintiff here is something that lurks in the back of our minds, and I think we've got to be mindful that what we're trying to do here is protect the back door. And if we are going to be influenced by the fact that we've got a pro se plaintiff, we're not doing our job. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
I'll take the microphone with me.
I think the colloquy about privity and mutuality gets to the heart of this dispute. Funny Guy is about a case in which the same defendant was sued twice sequentially. This is not that case. This is a case in which the trial court found, as a matter of law, that in the first action, that Mrs. Lane named an improper party. We can quibble about the exact wording of the order, but the order means that BWW Law Group was not the proper party. Then the court went on to recite a number of findings, which are clearly advisory, in my opinion. And I do not think it can be credibly argued that Bayview would take the position that it was bound by that order if it had gone against them. And I don't think that it would be fair for this court to find that if that case had gone against Bayview, that it was bound by that proceeding. And
does privity hinge on the underlying identity of interest, like you are co-owners of a piece of property, or it's a parent corporation, a subsidiary, or something like that? Or does it hinge on the skill of the defense that is mounted at, so it was very effective and well-lawyered, and therefore there is privity? I thought it was the former, but can you help me? Because it seems like there's an argument that maybe that's not that at all. It's that how the defense was conducted and the effectiveness of it.
I think it involves an inquiry into the facts surrounding the relationship between the parties that are claiming privity. I don't think it's the effectiveness of the defense. I think the question is, and frankly, it seems to be a sort of totality of the circumstances assessment that this court and trial courts make on an individualized basis. So are these two parties in privity? Do they share interests like two co-owners of a property? Now, I think the issue would become with two co-owners of a property is a good example. Is let's say one of those owners has no notice of the proceeding, and then there's a adverse ruling against the other owner, and then the new owner, the second owner, wants to relitigate that issue.
Or they just don't care and they just let it go to default.
That's possible. But I'm not sure that in that circumstance this court would find privity, because as it's held in Funny Guy, it's about a one full and fair opportunity to litigate the case. And I don't think it can be said in this appeal that Mrs. Lane had her full and fair opportunity to litigate these issues against the proper parties.
But you do understand, of course, if you get another bite at the apple, the dicta in the first proceeding has no role. The next judge has to review the case entirely de novo without any influence of the earlier decision except the persuasive influence.
I agree with that. And I see my time is up, so I'll conclude. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you.
Call the next case.